the measure, the only measure by which we will be judged by the children of today, and the only measure by which we'll be judged by the humans who come after, presuming that there are any, is the health of the land. The kids who are 7 years old today are not going to care about whether we recycled. They're not going to care about whether we voted Democrat or Republican. They're not going to care about whether we read really good books or we wrote really big books or whether we made a film. They're not going to care about any of that. What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and breathe the air and whether the land will support them.
All right. Welcome back, everybody, to the Death in the Garden podcast. I believe this is episode number 6.
Yeah, thank you to everyone for listening and supporting us and reaching out to us via email and Instagram and all of these places where people have reached out to us. It means so much to feel like we're supported, especially right now. Our morale is a little bit low and we've been facing a lot of resistance recently. So thank you to everyone who's here and who's been listening. It means a lot to us.
Yeah, this project is a lot of work and we bit off as much as we can chew, but it's a big chunk. So we're working really hard on this podcast and all of our content and the film itself. And it's all self-funded. So it's a lot of work. And so when we hear from you guys, when you guys leave comments and you send us emails, like, it's so cool. Like, if there was one thing that I could say is like maybe the happiest is like getting emails from people and like people sharing their opinion about like our work. Like, that is so cool. So thank you guys. Absolutely. This episode is with Derek Jensen, a very prolific writer. He would be called an eco-philosopher. And to the truest sense, he's an eco-philosopher and is probably one of the most poetic, intelligent, empathic people we've ever met.
Yeah, this was definitely one of our favorite conversations that we've had. It was profound and incredibly inspiring, and we feel like he put language to a lot of things that we have felt intuitively but weren't eloquent enough to describe them.
It was one of those experiences where I feel like you have an idea or you have something that's precognitive, and then somebody like Derek, who's so much more better with the English language and words, kind of
more better with the English language.
Exactly, more better with the English language, says something or writes something that is like that aha, not that it's necessarily a new concept, but that he brought it into the world, you know? And so this whole conversation was these like, yes moments of like, I've been trying to find a way of communicating that.
Yeah, and communicating it with, like, an assuredness. And, of course, you know, that comes with his extensive knowledge and life experience. And we were really lucky because when we reached out to Lierre Keith, she basically immediately was like, yeah, you can interview me, but you're also going to interview Derek. So she was like, it's a two for the price of one interview. And so we were like, hell yeah, that's awesome. And so we're just so grateful for this interview because, God, this podcast like is a gift to us, and we're excited to be bestowing this knowledge and this information to the rest of the world.
Bestowing it upon you.
Yeah. Cause it means a lot to us. Derek is an incredible dude.
I really encourage you to listen to this one and like, please share this one with people because this one really has nothing to do with us, but about ideas and concepts that are so profound that affect everybody. And he's somebody, his words and his work needs attention and it needs people interacting with it and sharing it and really embodying it. And we loved it. Yeah. It was one of those moments in life where we didn't really expect this interview to happen, but it happened. And, you know, I had all these questions lined out and all these things prepared. And I didn't really ask any of those questions because he kind of covered them all. And he kind of intuited what we wanted to know and what the questions we were looking to ask were.
Yeah. And I think that he really went like above and beyond with that too. This podcast, I would say, is probably the most aligned with sort of our philosophy around this project. So definitely if this podcast aligns with you and you're interested in it, please share with your friends. We think that this one is super, super important. We talk about plant sentience. We talk about the rise and fall of civilizations. how modernity affects our psyches, how we got to this critical point with our society and environment, and just all of these other types of topics that are kind of perfectly aligned with what we're trying to convey with this project.
Yeah, and I think one of the cool ideas, and I'll keep it at this, is that, you know, maybe this will pique your interest, that is this whole sustainable energy or sustainable movement with food and energy, are we just trying to save civilization, or are we actually trying to save the rest of the planet? Where are the interests lying within these movements?
Right.
Just as a preface, if you've listened to some of our other podcasts, you'll know that a handful of these interviews we are going to be releasing weren't recorded as podcasts. They were recorded as film interviews. So we didn't really have our voices recorded properly. You can still hear us, and it seems pretty audible, but just know going into this that this wasn't recorded as a podcast. It was recorded as kind of a film interview that turned into a really cool conversation. So we try to clean up the audio and make it presentable to you guys, but just keep that in mind so you're not kind of questioning why our voices are so quiet or not really present.
For sure. Yeah, we would be remiss to not share this with the world. So thanks for listening.
What a cool conversation, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
Yep.
My name is Derek Jensen, and I'm a writer. I have 20-some books out, mainly about stopping the murder of the planet. And that's mainly it.
I saw one of the titles of your books was A Language Older Than Words. Maybe you could... What does that mean to you? You know, because I think it's a very interesting concept, and I think it's something that a lot of people, from what I read that to mean, don't understand, and it's allowed a lot of what we see in the world.
So the way A Language Older Than Words, the book, starts is there is a language older by far and deeper than words. It's the language of gesture, symbol, memory, dream. And we have forgotten this language and forgotten it so long ago and so profoundly that we no longer even remember that it exists. Except I think I said a little bit better than that. And what that's really about is that there is this presumption that humans are the only ones who have language, and that all other languages, all other species are mute and have nothing to say and are not full beings. And I mean, it's just absurd even on its face that I don't know if you've ever been in an elevator with a bunch of people speaking a foreign language, speaking some language that you don't speak. But, I mean, honestly, it sounds like the same word over and over. It's my niece is a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine, got her medical degree in Beijing, and is married to a man from China, and her children, in the family, they often speak Chinese, and when they're around, I mean, it's the same deal. I mean, my point is, it's not racist to say that a foreign language sounds like not a language. And only someone who was profoundly supremacist would presume that because I can't decode the other language, that therefore it's not a language. And yet we do that with non-humans all the time. That... And often it's been done, European explorers said of Africans, when they speak, they fart with their tongues in their mouths. It wasn't a language. And we go back to the Greeks, and the word barbarian comes from the fact that the Greeks thought that the people from the north were speaking gibberish. They were saying ba, 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 ba. That's where barbarian comes from. So there's this notion that we speak, nobody else speaks. And this is really important because before you can exploit somebody, you really have to silence them. You have to or rather you have to deafen yourself to their voice or in effect silence them. And you know, we see this with the silencing of women, the silencing of children, and we certainly see it in the silencing of non-humans. There's so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. Or another way to say this is that we in the West generally perceive non-humans, we perceive the rest of the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And a couple of great examples of that. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. And another line like that is, I live near the coast, and a few years ago in the newspaper, they were saying why crabbers work so hard during the crabbing season. And one of the reasons is that every crab is worth $1.50. And the reporter said, so imagine if there's all these envelopes scattered all over the ground and every envelope has $1.50 in it. You would run around picking them up as fast as you can. Well, that's nice, except that crabs aren't actually envelopes filled with $1.50. They are other beings with lives as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And that doesn't mean that nobody ever eats anybody. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that everybody has their own wild and wonderful life that is valuable to them. And they're not dollars on the stump. Trees are other beings with lives as valuable to them as mine is to me, yours is to you. And all this is really important because how you perceive another affects how you behave toward that other. This, by the way, this is way off the subject, but this is one of the reasons that I am opposed to pornography, is because one of the things that does is it teaches men to perceive women as orifices. And if when I look at a woman, I see orifices, I'm going to treat her one way. And if when I look at a woman, I see a woman, I'll treat her another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And it's the same. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about women or trees or men or dogs or cows or beavers or ants or mosquitoes. So what I'm trying to get at with that line about a language older than words is that just because they don't speak English doesn't mean they don't speak.
Yeah, last night I was reading there was an exchange between a philosopher, I think his name is Johnson Bonmatsu.
Oh, something Matsu, yeah.
And so I was kind of reading the sort of like, you know, what he wrote about your book, yeah. And then what you wrote back to him, and then what he wrote back to you. And it was profound to me how he's this guy who's like obviously a vegan or something, and he was so hell-bent on the delineation between subjects and objects, yeah. And the lack of sentience of everything that isn't human, with the exception of animals. Like, it was just a really weird like line that he was drawing, and you know, maybe you could speak on more how that separation causes us to just destroy.
Well, I think one of the most destructive notions that humans have ever come up with is the great chain of being, which is the notion that you have a completely disembodied God up here, and then comes... So I'm going to start over because I used the plural when I should have used, or singular when I should use plural. So one of the most destructive ideas that humans have ever come up with is the great chain of being, where you have a hierarchy from the perfect and disembodied down to the corrupted, completely embodied non-living. And so you have God at the top, who is a disembodied being, and then you have angels, and then after angels, we have, well, kings, and then we have the court. Queens will be in there somewhere, and then you have commoners, of course, men above women, and we see this all the time where men are considered to be the brainiacs, and the women are considered to be embodied and contain the temptations of the body. And then you have indigenous people who are, in this perspective, more animalistic. And then you have various mammals, and then I don't know what order the animals come in after that. But you've got other animals basically ranked on how close they are to us. And then you have plants, then precious stones, then rocks, then soil, or I don't know how it goes down there. But the point is that at the top you have perfect and disembodied, and at the bottom you have completely embodied. And it's the notion of, I mean, where do we go when we die? When we die, we go to heaven, which is a completely disembodied place. It's a place where there is no death. There is no sex. There is nothing of the body. And part of the problem with, okay, I completely understand the desire to, I completely understand how factory farming would make anyone oppose that. But that's not, but that doesn't alter the fact. I'm going to back up and go a different direction. I was, you know, I'm going to wait until he's gone too.
I'm also going to adjust this real quick before we continue.
So another way to talk about all this is, decades ago now, I interviewed Neil Everndon, and one of the things I asked him is, so if you don't draw the line between significant humans and non-significant non-humans, where do you draw the line? And his answer was perfect and was a homecoming for me, which was, why do you have to draw the line at all? And also I interviewed this guy, Cleve Baxter, who is a really interesting guy who was an expert in lie detector tests. And one day he was bored and he attached the lie detector to his, to a plant, a Dracaena plant, and wanted to figure out how long it would take for the water to go from where he watered it up to the leaves, where it would then affect the conductivity of the leaves and change its response on the lie detector. And as he was waiting for it, he just got this idea, what would happen if I burned it? And as he thought, what would happen if I burned it, the plant responded. And that changed everything in his life. And a lot of people thought he was a crackpot, but I interviewed him, and after the interview, he left me alone in the room with it attached to, with the electrodes on yogurt, which is, of course, a living being. And I tried pretending I was angry. I tried all these things and nothing worked. And then I happened to see an advertisement, a calendar that had a pretty picture on it. And I looked at the picture closer and I saw that it was not just a calendar, but instead, it was an advertisement. And I had this sort of instant anger at the fact that advertising is everywhere. And so I ran over to the chart, and I saw the moment that I had this flare of anger, the chart spiked. the yogurt had responded. So I've actually experienced this. And my point in bringing him up, you can cut all the rest if you want, my point in bringing him up is that one of the things that Clee Baxter said that was great was that for not much long, okay, the tools of science, the ability to measure, the scientists' ability to measure is outstripping their ability to deny that non-humans have sentience. And that's absolutely true. He said that in the 90s, and we've seen it more and more as there are more and more people who are talking about plant sentience and talking about Stefano Mancuso in Italy is assembling, and he and his teams are assembling a dictionary of some plant languages. And what that means is that plants will communicate not through speaking. They don't have vocal cords unless maybe the sound of wind through the leaves is a way of speaking. But one of the primary ways they speak is through sending out pheromones, through sending chemical signals. And if a caterpillar is eating the leaf of a certain species of plant, it'll send out messages to other plants across species saying, hey, you need to change the composition of your leaves to make it so it's not palatable to insects, to the caterpillar. And so Baxter's point was that our meters, our instruments are getting sensitive enough that we're now able to pick up these communications between other species. And it ends up that plants send off all sorts of messages all the time. He has assembled a dictionary of like a couple thousand chemical phrases that different plants will send, having to do with being dry, having to do with predators, having to do with... I've actually witnessed this. I had a tree when I lived in Spokane that got an infestation of aphids, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to get rid of them. I didn't want to spray the tree, and so I didn't do anything. And a couple weeks later, I saw all these little orange grubs all over the tree, and then those grubs grew up, and it ends up they were ladybug larvae. And so what happens is, I didn't know that that's how it works, but the way it works is the tree sends out messages to the ladybug saying either A, help, I mean, it's like a 911, you know, help, send some first responders, or it could be, hey, there's a party here, there's a feast. In any case, they're saying, some aphids here, come on over. And part of the point of this is that as soon as you recognize that the great chain of being doesn't exist and it's not humans at the top, and there is no top, but instead what there is all these beings as wonderful and gifted in their own ways as you are in your ways, then life becomes a lot more morally complex. It's not so simple that if it doesn't have a face or a mother, then it doesn't feel anything. That's no longer a scientifically tenable position. And I don't think it was ever a morally tenable position. And that doesn't mean that a lot of times they'll say, well, they'll just throw their hands up and say, well, great, so what does that mean? That means you think it's okay to torture cows? It's like, no. I just don't think it's okay to torture trees either. I want to say one more thing about this, which is that... So another response... excuse me. Another response that people have sometime is, well, this means that, I mean, are you just never supposed to eat? And maybe 15, 18 years ago, there was somebody told me that I am, because I use toilet paper, I'm just as responsible for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. excuse me. And I said to the person, no, that doesn't seem right. But I didn't really have a rebuttal to it. And then one day I was walking through the forest and I asked a tree, I explained my concern to a tree. It's like, so here's the situation. What's the response? And the tree said back to me immediately, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. And it also said, yes, you are actually culpable for deforestation, but not because you use toilet paper. You're culpable for deforestation because there is a fundamental predator-prey relationship which you are not participating in. And the fundamental predator-prey relationship is if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. And this is true whether we're talking about, and bears know that if bears eat all the salmon, there won't be any salmon in the future. And mergansers know that if they eat all the newts in the pond, there won't be any newts in the pond in the future. And so I am culpable for deforestation, but not because I use toilet paper. I'm culpable for deforestation because I use toilet paper and I don't stop Weyerhaeuser. If you consume the flesh of a tree, you take responsibility for the continuation of the forest community. And you can say, well, that's crazy, Derek. Trees can't talk to you. But that's actually not the point. That's just how we got here. And the point is, this is true. It doesn't matter whether that came to me from a tree, the muse, my own mind. It doesn't matter. The truth is, as we see, if the wolves eat all the buffalo, there won't be any buffalo and there won't be any wolves. Everybody knows this, except us. We forget. So it doesn't mean that nobody ever gets to eat anybody. It means that your act of consumption pledges your responsibility to their community. And one more thing I guess I want to say about that is that I love the line by Paul Stamets, which is nature loves a community. And, you know, I see individual bears and I fall in love with individual bears, and I see individual trees and I fall in love with individual trees. But ultimately, I don't think nature cares so much about the individual as it does the continuation of the community, because the individual is going to die. And in fact, the very tree that I was walking by when I asked that question, the tree that I perceived as telling me that, has since been killed by bears. And anyway, the point is that is that you're going to die and I'm going to die. And the most important thing is the continuation of the larger natural community. That's always the most important thing.
How would you say we can impress upon people the importance of this ecosystem holistic relationship that we all are part of?
So, John Livingston talked about, he thought that we were an entire culture suffering from hallucinations. And when I go to a city, I normally, like if I'm on tour, at the end of the event, I'll go back to my hotel room and pull the drapes shut and turn the lights off and basically stay in the dark until I have to go to the next town, because I feel like cities are places of sensory overload where there's just too many people, too many radios, too much concrete, too many sharp edges. And that's true. But Livingston makes the alternative point that at the same time they are places of severe sensory deprivation. You know, we hear all the time about how humans are going to meld with machines, and there's going to be this singularity where humans and machines, we're going to be put into machines, and we will be living inside the machine. I got bad news for those people, which is, it's already happened. And what I mean by that is, what percentage of your perceptions every day come either from humans or are mediated by humans, as opposed to what percentage come from non-humans? I find it appalling and horrifying that I touch plastic more than I touch flesh, human or otherwise. That's extraordinary. And most of us spend most of our time inside. I mean, I would challenge anybody watching this film to look around right now and to ask yourself how many of your sensory perceptions right now are created by or mediated by humans as opposed to non-humans. And also think about how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? My computer, my clock, television, car, lights, all those. And on the other hand, how many non-humans, wild animals or wild plants do you have a daily relationship with? Probably none. And how many advertising jingles can you name? Or if I say to you, Charlize Theron, if I say to you, Mel Gibson, if I say to you, Brad Pitt, if I say to you, Angelina Jolie, if I say to you, McDonald's, if I say to you, Wendy's, if I say to you, Coca-Cola, you can probably conjure up images. How many edible species of plants or fungi can you name within 100 yards of your home? Probably not many. And I'm not like attacking anybody. I can't do it either. And the point is that we're living in an echo chamber where we only hear our own voices. And Livingston's point was that if you are in an echo chamber, a sensory deprivation chamber, you start to hallucinate. And he believes that most of our ideologies are hallucinations. And that sounds really crazy, but think about it for a second. What do all of the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is having to conform to industrial capitalism. And that is insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. That's the literal definition of insanity, being out of touch with physical reality. Because without a living planet, you don't have any social system whatsoever. So the health of the planet has to be primary. It has to be more important than your social system. Because without that healthy planet, there is no social system. And no social system can last that continually destroys its ecological foundation. The societies that have survived, that have been sustainable, have been those that have not harmed the land. I mean, think about it. If you have the land is on a health on a scale of 1 to 100, if you're harming the land even 1% a year, it goes from 100 to 99 to 98 to 97. Even if it's linear, eventually it's going to get to zero. If you have uncountable salmon, and then you can count them, and then there's a million, and then there's 750,000. That's still a lot. But if the trend is downward, you know, a lot of my work is just based on the understanding that trends are real. And that, you know, 40% of the wildlife has been wiped out in the last 50 years. I don't understand why people don't see that trend. You know, earlier, before the film started, we were talking about the fact that, you know, a couple days ago I saw 10 bears. I usually see 5 or 6 bears a day. And That's really exciting. Wow, it's amazing. Except if you lived here prior to conquest and there's water right over there, if you were near a river or stream, you would have seen a grizzly bear every 15 minutes, which means in an hour you'd see four. In 12 hours, you'd see 48. So even this overload of bears that I have is trivial compared to what it was before. And, you know, we talk about how in the Central Valley in California, there were waterfowl so thick that you couldn't see the sun. And there were flocks of passenger pigeons in the east that were so large they darkened the sky for days at a time. And that's unimaginable. San Francisco Bay, the early European explorers said it was, quote, paved with sea lions, end quote. You know, we think of bears as solitary animals, but, you know, I see a fair number at a time these days, and I've been talking to some bear people about this, and bears aren't supposed to be completely solitary animals. The early European explorers would see, quote, troops, end quote, of grizzly bears. And we don't see those patterns. And so what do I say to people who don't understand that? You know, part of the problem, too, is that we get confused as to what's real. And we get confused as to, there are many layers of reality going on at the same time. Okay, you have to pay rent, so there's the financial reality. And if you run out of money, you know, how are you going to pay rent? That's one reality. Another reality is that, you know, I have a finite number of minutes in my life, and every minute that I spend playing Left 4 Dead 2 is a minute that's gone forever. And we forget that. And then there's also the reality that everything you eat came from somewhere, and everything you drink came from somewhere. And part of the problem is that if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from a tap, you're going to defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it. If your experience is that your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you're going to defend to the death those because your life depends on it. And part of the problem is that systematically and functionally, the system has inserted itself between us and the source of life so that we are dependent. Ultimately, everything comes from the earth, but we perceive ourselves and experience ourselves as dependent on the system as opposed to life, as opposed to the planet. And so that's one reason we can make these insane comments like environmentalism is now more about saving civilization than it is saving the planet. And that's how we can get there, is because we have gotten confused over what's real. And we can go into the history of that confusion if you want or not. It doesn't matter.
Please do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That was my next question, was, you know, history. Yeah. Why would we ever do this? How did we get here? Like, why?
Well, there's an interesting exchange of letters between an 1830s pro-slavery philosopher from the South and his northern abolitionist buddy. And in this, the southern pro-slavery philosopher says, we would get rid of our slaves immediately if the land ownership conditions could be arranged such that, excuse me, I'll start over. We would get rid of our slaves immediately if the land ownership conditions could be arranged so that it was economically viable to do so. And it's really simple, which is, if there's a lot of land and not many people, then that means people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency. If there are a lot of people, as in a city, and not much land, That means people don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they will go to work for you for any pittance. On the other hand, if there's a lot of land, the only way you can get them to work for you is at the point of a gun. And those in power have known this forever. And I don't mean some sort of conspiracy. It's like my friend George Raffin says that you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. This is just how the system works. It's how an abusive system works. This is why abusers will so often separate their victims from their families, is because they're removing social support systems. Because if there's a social support system, the victim can get away and go somewhere else. But if you have deprived the victim of their social support system, and you also have made it economically infeasible for them to work on their own, or perhaps they have 3 or 4 children at this point, and they don't know how to raise 3 or 4 children on their own, working 3 or 4 jobs and still be a parent, be a mother, then that makes it so much more difficult. It was no coincidence that the first time my father beat my mother was after she was pregnant. That is standard. It's much harder to leave. And we can also, we can jump to another level and talk about apartheid South Africa, where apartheid, the laws of apartheid were put in place not simply out of hatred and racism. They were put in place, the ostensible reason was to provide workers for mines, because they had mines, gold mines, diamond mines, and they needed workers. Problem is that the local people were living in, were subsistence farmers and hunter-gatherers, and had no need of a cash economy. So from the perspective of the mine owner, how are you going to get people? Nobody wants to go down to the mine. How are you going to work it? Well, what they did is they put in hut taxes, poll taxes, dog taxes. So people had to pay taxes. To pay taxes, they got to pay cash. They got to get cash. They live in a cashless economy. They lived where, you know, she gives me her cow this year, and next year I give her my cow, and it all works out. And we build up social capital, but there's no cash. So how are you going to get cash? Well, it looks like somebody's going to have to go work in the mine. And that was how it started in that country. The point is that we are dependent upon a system that is systematically destroying the planet. And one of the ways that it has been made so that our loyalty is with the system rather than the planet is because we eat from the system. You know, people have asked me, what lessons do I want to learn from COVID? And one lesson I wish we would learn socially is it's really stupid to rely on places across the world for the things that are necessary for your survival. And, I mean, there's lots of other things we need. You know, we need resistance. We need to stop the murder of the planet. And then also one of the steps toward this is relocalizing food systems, because it's absolutely insane. You know, when I lived in Spokane, I had chickens outside my door. I raised chickens. And part of the reason I raised them was one statement that my mom made about her grandmother one day. She said her grandmother never threw away any food because she had chickens, and she would just stand by the open door when she was making dinner, and any peelings or anything, she just threw out the window, and the chickens ate them. And that seemed like a great idea, so that's actually why I got started with chickens. Anyway, the point is, at one point in A Language Older Than Words, my friend and I go to a Vietnamese restaurant and have dinner. And then we track where everything came from. We track that the broccoli came from Mexico. And we were making it up because we don't know where exactly this chicken or this broccoli came from. But the broccoli probably came from Mexico. The chicken probably came from this horrible factory farm in Arkansas. And we go through all this. And at the end of the piece, I say, and I got chickens outside my door. I mean, that's just crazy to rely on foreign food. Anyway, so how did it start? Leah can answer that better with the whole agriculture question, but the important thing from my perspective is that when you have, it helps the economy, and it is necessary to the economy. Why would I go to Albertsons or Safeway and buy or Walmart and buy groceries if there's salmon in the stream? Why would I do that? You know, I had this friend who was married to a guy from Bangladesh, and in his lifetime, when he was younger, his mother would say to him, go down to the river and catch us some lunch. And he would go down to the river and catch some fish for lunch. And that was when he was a teen. And by his early 20s, the river was so polluted, there were no fish, and anybody who wants to eat fish has to buy them from Iceland. That's how the whole system works. And that's why we end up depending on the system and caring about the system more, because how am I going to get the fish? They're not in the river anymore. Excuse me.
Do you think there was like a to touch back on the question of why, it seems almost like there was this movement towards, like, who knows who did it, why did it, to, like, conglomerate power and take it away from the masses. And it seems like, you know, that you're right, that's like, the less that people can provide for themselves, the more power in turn it gives to the few. You know, do you agree with that?
Yeah, and that's been known. I mean, the way you win wars is by depriving the enemy of their capacity to wage war. And the reason the Allies won World War II in Europe, two reasons. One of them is the Russian army just, you know, being the whole Eastern Front being a meat grinder, literally. And the other is the Allied bombing campaigns that destroyed the German war capacity. The reason I bring that up is because why did they kill the buffalo? I mean, yeah, they used some of them, but one of the reasons they did it is to destroy the storehouse of the Plains Indians. And it's like Sherman's March to the Sea. You know, what you want to do, if you're in a war, is you want to destroy the enemy's capacity to not be dependent upon you. That's why there was an Allied blockade in World War II. That's why there was a Union blockade in the Civil War. You want to make your enemy dependent on you. And another way to say all this is that, you know, Kropotkin talked about how so many revolutions have foundered because of bread. 60 days, you start starving to death. And if you don't have a way to provide food for the people, you're not going to have a revolution. And I don't in any way mean that this is any sort of big grand conspiracy by five Illuminati or something. This is just how power works. Again, this is how it works on the individual level of abusers, where they control the finances and control the capacity of the other to live independently. Because, I mean, why would somebody work a job they don't like if they have the capacity to be independent? Why would somebody stay in an abusive relationship if you know, it's so interesting. People generally, if they live someplace they love, almost everybody hates it when somebody new moves into the neighborhood. It's like, there goes the neighborhood. There's yet another person moving in and cutting down more trees. Except at the same time, then they'll say, but gosh, it's really good for the economy. It's great because they'll make more jobs. I mean, they're going to start a new business, make more jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this bifurcation that people feel, this split, this dissonance, with they don't really like it, but, well, it's going to be good for the economy.
Yeah, what is that, like, capitalist impulse? And I don't get the desire to defend it, or even to, I don't know, it just confuses me.
Well, it is the only thing they've ever known. It's the only thing I've ever known, you've ever known. It's what we live in. The system is pretty ubiquitous and fairly universal. Or there's a deeper question here, which maybe Lierre can go into if you want to, of, you know, Mary Daly talked about how there's only one religion in the world right now, and it's patriarchy. Or another way to say this, there's only one religion in the world, and it's necrophilia. So yeah, it has been a totalizing system. And I think one reason that we do defend capitalism is that we do benefit from it. And how do we benefit? We get access to ice cream 24/7. We get, you know, Lewis Mumford addressed this question, and he said that his question was, how have we surrendered ourselves so completely to the modern authoritarians who are much smarter than the sort of half-baked authoritarians of previous times, where if you disagree with them, they would bash you in the head? And he said that the brilliant thing about the modern authoritarians is that they have offered to us what he called a magnificent bribe. And the bribe consists of electronics, ice cream, nice houses, vehicles. It consists of what he called the democratization of, the benefits of the system, whereby they and their promise are handed out to a significant enough percentage of the people to get them to buy in, to get everybody to buy in. And the deal that we're asked to agree to is that we will receive goodies in quality and quantity hitherto inconceivable in exchange for asking only for what the system will give us and demanding nothing that it cannot give us and giving up on life on earth. And we do have it. We do. You know, even when my mom was a little girl in the 30s, for Christmas one year, she got an orange. And that was a big deal. And it was great, and she loved it. I can go get a dozen oranges. I can be back in 15 minutes from Walmart, have oranges any time of year. I should say, quote, oranges. And we have power devoted to us at a level that the most decadent of the Roman emperors could only have dreamed of. Could a decadent Roman emperor have traveled across an entire continent in 6 hours? Could this decadent Roman emperor... Okay, there's something that William R. Catton talked about, which are ghost slaves. And those are the energy that we use, you know, turn on a light. Think about this. If you had the pedal to make the electricity, to generate the electricity for a refrigerator, for a light, you'd have to pedal pretty hard. I've actually done this before. God, when I was a kid, there was this thing, you could turn a crank and a light bulb would go on. And it wouldn't go on very bright. And I remember I'm like 9 years old and I'm just cranking as hard as I can. I get tired pretty quick. And I don't think that if you personally had to crank them, I don't think there would be very many people who would have hot tubs. I don't think there'd be very many people who would have marijuana grows. I don't think there'd be very many people with refrigerators. We have all those. And William R. Catton called that energy that comes from those ghost slaves. I'm going to stop for a second. Do you remember his number on about how many ghost slaves the individual would have?
2,000.
Americans? Or?
Yeah, Americans.
Okay. So now I'll just pretend that I knew that. So Catton says that all of us, because of our energy use, have at our disposal the equivalent of 2,000 ghost slaves at any time. You would have had to be really, really rich. Maybe the Roman emperor would have had 2,000 slaves at his disposal. But even the worst of the southerners, most of the plantations didn't have 2,000 slaves. That's a lot. And we all have that. And that's one of the reasons why we defend capitalism, because it brings this energy-intensive life to us that is... So where did you wake up this morning?
In a van in a forest somewhere.
No, but where? What city was closest?
Cave Junction.
So Cave Junction. That's a pretty short drive, but 300 years ago, Cave Junction to here would have been... Okay, were there horses here 300 years ago?
No, those came with the Europeans.
I know, but were the Europeans here? But maybe they would have...
Well, the horses, I mean, they were released pretty early on by their...
Yeah, but they make it up here, you think? I'll bet not.
I'm not 100% sure how far the horses
are. Well, I'm going to say 500 years ago, then, and make it easy. Okay, so... You woke up this morning in Cave Junction, drove down here, pretty easy drive, but if this were 500 years ago, Cave Junction would have been at least, I would say, 4 days fairly hard walk, maybe six. And that's if you got a nice trail. And even on horseback, it would have been a very hard 2 days, probably 3 days. We have all of these... I mean, I love the planet more than I love these luxuries, but I like hot showers. And that's one of the goodies we get. And we're killing the world because these goodies, these comforts and elegancies are more important to us than life on the planet.
It's like a trap.
It's completely a trap. Yeah, it's we got the cheese. Well, like Mumford said. Yeah, I said it. I said it. What was it? Bill Hicks had this thing about how there was another comic plagiarized his routine. And then Bill Hicks said, actually, I plagiarized it, but I did it with a twist, which is I plagiarized it even before he did it.
In a hypothetical situation, it's like as I'm learning about more and more like human history, there's this like insatiable knack to make shit and invent shit, and we're really good at making tools. And in my head, it's like, oh, I would love for us to take a step back and check ourselves and be part of the greater whole. But I don't see us stopping this like. Need to make shit and create shit. Do you see in a hypothetical situation us like reconciling that desire but not fucking up the planet?
Well, I mean, people have been, humans have been making gadgets forever, and they've been making things forever. But that doesn't mean they've been making destructive, ecologically destructive things forever. Because there's this idea that, you know, because humans live on the land, therefore it's okay for Boise Cascade to clear cut. I mean, I've actually heard environmental philosophers say that because Indians affected the land, therefore, and it's a very common position that just drives me batty. But there's a big difference, which is Ray Rafael talked about how the regional Indians would make land use decisions, and his big thing was, yes, of course they affected the land, but they were planning on living there for the next 500 years. And if you make land use decisions, planning on living there for the next 500 years, you make different land use decisions. Another way to talk about this is the Okanagan Indian writer and activist Jeanette Armstrong talked to me about a conflict resolution method that the Okanagans use, which is called Analkin. And to introduce it, she said, you know, we Indians have the same problems that you white people have. We get mad at each other. We have spats. We don't like each other. The big difference is I recognize that my great-grandchildren might marry your great-grandchildren, so we have to figure out how to get along. And their Analkin process, which they specifically want to spread around the world, which is Analkin means I challenge you to give me your most opposite perspective to mine so I can increase my understanding. And they have trained facilitators who will work this. It doesn't mean that you have to listen to everybody talk all the time. The trained facilitators will say, no, we've already heard that one. Don't bring it up again. And Also, she said, you can only do this with people who aren't trying to steal what you've got. You can't do it with a thief. You can't do it with somebody who's trying to steal your land. It only works if you and I are having a conflict over whether we were going to do this interview today or tomorrow. You know, we could hash it out, or some other conflict where we need to resolve it. My point is that if you're planning on living in place for a long time, you will have different inventions too. And there were societies who would break people into groups to express those different concerns. So you might have, and among the Okanagan, she talked about this, that they would break into, if there was going to be some major community decision, they would discuss it, and two of the groups that would break out would be the elders and the youths. And the youths were oftentimes more creative. Yes, we want to make this change. And the elders are very concerned with tradition. And how will this affect the long term? And so let's say somebody invents a plow and they want to start plowing up a field. In a sane community, you would have decisions about whether we actually want to implement this, whether we want to use this, whether it will be good for, whether we'll still be able to live here in 500 years if we do it. And that's the good news, is that there are humans who have existed who have made reasonable decisions on the sorts of art they're going to make, on the sorts of gadgets they're going to make, on the sorts of inventions they will and won't put to use. The bad news is that if you want to put inventions to use that destroy the land, these will often give you a competitive advantage over your neighbors in war. So, for example, the North Africa used to be heavily forested, and then the forests of North Africa went down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. And if one culture is making chariots and warships out of their forest, and the other group is not, the group that's making chariots and warships is going to have a competitive advantage over the other culture, which is the history of the last 5,000 years. So basically, as soon as you get one or two rotten apples, they're going to spoil a bunch. And that is a circumstance, that is a problem to which obviously no one has yet found the answer, otherwise we wouldn't be in the position we're in. So will there ever be a time in the future when humans are again living in some harmony with the land? By definition, either yes or we won't be living at all. You know, decades ago, I was stuck in traffic with my friend George Drafin, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George was in a terrible mood, and he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we'll be living there again someday, or we won't be living at all. And the only question really is what's left of the world when we get there. He's right. You know, I can summarize all of my work in one or two sentences, which is, this way of living will not last forever. And when it's done, I would prefer that there's more of the world left rather than less. That's it. That's everything. And there's one more thing I want to talk about with this too, which is, part of the problem is that technologies themselves take over. They run the show. And I, again, got this from Lewis Mumford. And he talked about something called a technic, T-E-C-H-N-I-C. And technologies don't arise in out of a vacuum. That the Talawa Indians, on whose land we are now, they didn't invent refrigerators, but not because they were too stupid. they didn't invent refrigerators because their entire way of life did not give rise to needing them. I mean, for one thing, salmon stays fresher in the river than it would even in a refrigerator. And his point is that certain technologies will emerge from and give rise to certain social forms. So if you have a certain social form, it would give rise to more weapons of war. A different social form might give rise to more Lascaux cave paintings, you know? It's your society creates a technology which then influences your society. And he broke technologies into democratic and authoritarian techniques. And what he means by that is that democratic societies will give rise to certain sorts of technologies, which will in turn add to the democracy, and certain authoritarian social forms will create other forms of technology, which will then lead to more authoritarian forms. And some good examples of this would be pottery or basket weaving. Basket weaving is a democratic technique because nobody can control your access to reeds. People can be better at it or worse at it, but nobody can control your access to it. And on the other hand, a gun is an authoritarian technique because somebody can control access to my gunpowder and bullets. A club would be, even though the question is not whether it's violent, a club could be a democratic technique because anybody can pick up a stick and nobody can control your access to it as part of it. And then also with a gun, one reason it's an authoritarian technique is because it requires mining. And if it requires mining, that means you have to force people into mines. And that means you're going to have an authoritarian power structure. Also, once you get the ore mined, then you have to have somebody you have to have smelting, and you have to have somebody to protect the smelted material. Otherwise, somebody will steal it. I mean, I'm not worried about you stealing a stick, because I'll just grab another stick. I mean, you don't need police to protect sticks. You do need police to protect iron ore or steel or whatever. And so his point is that right now there are a lot of calls to abolish the police. These people need to read Mumford, because what happens in places if they actually abolished all the police in the United States, the electrical grid would not last a week. Because what happens in failed states, people steal the electrical wires to recycle them because they're worth money. And, I mean, forgetting all the other problems, it's like, if there is no enforcement system whatsoever, there's going to be no commerce. And on the global scale, I mean, plants and trees, I mean, trees and bears would say, great, no economic commerce among the humans. I'm down for that. But how are you going to get access to the fried chicken that was raised in Georgia? Anyway, point is that these authoritarian systems or these technologies require certain social structures. And so that's why he called them authoritarian techniques. The other reason he called them authoritarian techniques is because the technology itself becomes in charge. And the way to think about this is, are cities designed more for human beings, or are they designed more for cars? They're actually designed for automobiles. And that works for us because, you know, you can drive around and you can park and you can walk in and buy your smoothie. And then you can get back in your car and you can listen to the radio while you drive to get your shoes. And that's all very convenient for that. But the truth is they are made, or like we talk about global warming, and they say, gosh, we can't get rid of the fossil fuel economy. Okay, we're talking about life on the planet. Who's in charge? Who's actually in charge is the fossil fuel economy. It's not human beings. Another way to think about this, I've asked tens of thousands of people this question over the years. Does the government take better care of human beings or corporations? There's not a single person has ever said human beings. Everybody says corporations. Corporations don't exist. They're a technique, really. they're a technology, they're a fiction. And the government takes better care of corporations than human beings. So who's in charge? We all acknowledge that corporations are in charge. That's crazy. And then I want to tell a story about this that just kind of cracks me up, that illustrates this whole notion of authoritarian techniques. That this guy was interviewing me several years ago, and he was a dedicated Marxist who believed that it's possible to have an industrial system with purely voluntary exchanges. So there's no coercion on anybody at all, ever. Everybody from each according to their means to each according to their needs. And this would all work out. And I said, great. Do you have any cities? He said, yep. I said, great. How do you get around in the city? He said, mass transit, buses. I said, great. What are your buses made of? He said, metal. I said, great. Where do you get the metal? He said, mines. I said, great. How do you get people to work in mines? Because, you know, mining is one of the first forms of slavery, and it's just a miserable existence. And you pay them a lot. I said, well, okay, I'll give you that. But every single mine that has ever existed, every hard rock mine, has polluted water. That's what they do. So what do you do about the people who live next to the river? Because you tell them to move. I said, what if they won't move? He said, you pay them a lot to move. I said, well, what if they've lived there for 5,000 years, their ancestors are buried there, and they refuse to move? He said, you pay them even more. I said, no, their ancestors are buried there. They will not leave their ancestors. He said, well, how many are there? I said, I don't know, 500. He said, well, the million people in the city vote, and they vote that those 500 people have to be kicked off their land. I said, great. So what you've done is in less than a minute, you've gone from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft from indigenous people, and genocide, all so you can have a bus. And the point is that one of the reasons that we have surrendered ourselves to the system is because we have surrendered ourselves to the system. I mean, the system, we have allowed the system to be in charge, and we've been bought off. That goes back to Magnificent Bribe. But the system really is in charge. And this is not a conspiracy. You know, you see this in abusive families, too. It's very interesting how different members of the family will fall into different dynamics. So you have the peacekeeper, you have the sacrificial lamb, you have these people, and they'll play out these roles. And the system, the family system, can keep getting more and more dysfunctional, and the individuals will just keep dancing faster and faster to try to keep up with the increasingly dysfunctional system, which of course is what we see on a larger scale too. And that's what we see on the end of every civilization. Joseph Tainter talked about this, that when civilizations collapse or start collapsing, what they often do is whatever it was that made them grow in power beforehand, they will continue to do that to stave off collapse. So if what really made you strong in the first place was making a whole bunch of giant stone heads, as things collapse, you make more giant stone heads. If what made you powerful in the first place was mass production, well, as things start going down, you just got to produce more. And I mean, I'm grateful that you're doing this film, and I'm grateful that people are trying to. And one of the things we need to do is to talk our way through and out of this. To talk, you know, if we're going to kill the planet, at least we can do is talk about it honestly. It's the first step. Or like a friend of mine says, a doctor friend, that proper diagnosis is the first step toward correct treatment. And if what we think is we need to just produce more to get out of it, then we're never going to.
And like, we've talked about this a lot making this film. We're like, we're under no illusion that we don't personally know if we're going to make it out of this. And we're not even making this with this sense that it's going to make a difference. But we want to have at least a conversation about it with a lot of people. And our thing is like, which kind of leads to one of my last questions for you. It's just like, because especially like our generation, there's a lot of people who feel what's going on. and it sucks because we have a lot of life to live, you know? And we're trying to have a conversation with the younger, like, I have nephews and nieces who are 7 to 15. It's like, fuck. I almost hope you don't realize what's going on because this blows, you know? But what do you, in your own life, what have you done to grapple with all this? And what advice do you give to other, can you give to other people to help make sense of this all and make it not hurt so much? Because personally, it hurts a lot, you know?
So about 10, 12 years ago, I was talking with a pesticides activist, anti-pesticides activist, who said to me, this work's just killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, I'll do that. And then she said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. Then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I thought a minute, and then I said the thing that I knew was the best possible thing to say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I thought it was the best possible thing to say is because when I was a young activist, maybe 3 or 4 years in the early 90s, I was going through this very hard time where I was just bursting into tears several times a week. And a lot of my activist friends were saying, just take some time off, Derek. You know, promise to be here when you come back. And I didn't want to do that because, I mean, if the death of the salmon isn't worth crying about, then what is worth crying about? And I one day called a friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, I've mentioned before, the Okanagan Indian writer and activist. And I said, man, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And then I said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. And then I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair. And it let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that sorrow is just sorrow and pain is just pain. And we spend more energy avoiding the sorrow and the pain than we do actually feeling it. And I can't tell you how many times I've been asked to write an essay for some magazine where they say, we want you to write about the apocalypse and then make sure to end on a happy note. And right now there aren't any happy notes. There are individual happy notes. There is a species of giant tortoise in the Galapagos that they have just quit doing the reintroduction of them and the captive breeding program because they're okay. They're doing well on their island. And so they're individual happy notes, but all in all, things are bad and they're getting worse. And you know, I have Crohn's disease, and when they came in to give me the diagnosis of Crohn's disease, they didn't say, the good news is, they just came in and said, I'm sorry, you have Crohn's disease. And then he left the room and gave me a couple hours to cry, and then he came back and talked to me about options. And the sorrow is just sorrow, and the pain's just pain, and it doesn't kill you. You can feel it, and it doesn't kill you. And it doesn't even, you know, I don't take it personally. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really screwed and that life's really good and life's a wonderful and beautiful thing and it's worth fighting for every moment. And there's another thing that happens when you allow yourself to feel it, which is that you know, you realize you can feel all that pain and sorrow and not die, but you realize also that you do feel that pain and sorrow when you do die. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. Because when you die in that way, it's not your animal you that dies. Your body doesn't die. The part of you that relied on the system dies. The part of you that thought, huh, there's a way out in this system. There's a hope that the system is going to save us. That part dies. So many indigenous people have said to me, the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And part of that decolonization is what I mentioned early on about recognizing that non-humans are living beings too, with lives as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And another part is recognizing that this system has been killing the planet for 6,000 years. You know, they say one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is when you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. That's what it was like prior to the beginnings of this culture. The first written myth of Western civilization and one of the first religious texts is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq to build a great city. Saudi Arabia was heavily forested. The Arabian Peninsula was not heavily forested, but oak savanna. And those were cut down for export. The Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. One of those dead Greek guys, I think it was Aristotle or Plato, one of those two, complained that deforestation was harming water quality. I got a letter a couple years ago from somebody who lives in the Mediterranean who said, I didn't know until recently that the Mediterranean is not supposed to be rocky. Up until the beginning of this culture, all these islands were heavily forested, and they were all cut down, and the rocks were where they're supposed to be, which is under the soil. So what we need to give up on is the notion that this way of life can last. And then there's another story I want to tell, because you were talking earlier about millennials and mortality, and there's this interesting novel I read a couple years ago called 13 Moons. It's by Charles Frazier, the guy who wrote Cold Mountain. And the book is basically a love story between this man and woman. And the love story was not that great. It was okay. But the other love story was between the male character and the land. And it was set from 1820 to 1900 in North Carolina. And there's a bit at the end that really hit me hard, which was this character is old. Everyone he ever loved has died. You know, it's just, this is what happens. And he says, we evolved where our elders will die. In most circumstances, our parents die before we do. Our older siblings die. Our aunts and uncles die. Our friends die. And then we get older, our abilities go away, and then we die. And he said, that's part of life, and we know, we evolve being able to handle that grief, however much it may be. But we did not evolve such that the forests themselves were dying. And we don't know how to handle that grief. We didn't evolve able to handle that grief. That there is supposed to be this continuity. Yes, an individual tree falls over and dies, and other trees spring up, and this bear dies, and another tree is, and another bear is born. But we're not supposed to go from seeing bears every 15 minutes to never seeing them at all. We're not supposed to go from a forest to no forest. And there's no place to contain that grief. And I think the measure, the only measure by which we will be judged by the children of today, and the only measure by which we'll be judged by the humans who come after, presuming that there are any, is the health of the land. The kids who are 7 years old today are not going to care about whether we recycled. They're not going to care about whether we voted Democrat or Republican. They're not going to care about whether we read really good books or we wrote really big books or whether we made a film. They're not going to care about any of that. What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and breathe the air and whether the land will support them. That's the only thing that matters. And for me, I mean, that's why I write my books. And I'm not saying we shouldn't write books. I'm not saying we shouldn't make films. I'm not saying that we shouldn't make love. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have fun. What I'm saying is that the basis of our morality and the legacy that we need to leave is the health of the land. And everything I do is aimed toward that.
Beautiful.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Thank you.
Yeah. It's like, it's been this weird grief process that we've been going through. And it is just that. Like, it's just something that we have to go through and just try to do our best to cultivate as a piece of land somewhere where we can feel like the rivers are clean here, at least. The air is clean here, there's food here.
The only real inheritance.
Yeah. Our whole thing, the part of the reason why death is such a big topic in our film is just the fact that we believe that the fear of acknowledging death has caused us to not understand finite systems, and that, you know, if you believe that your grandmother is going to live forever, if you never acknowledge the fact that she's going to die, you might not tell her all the things you want to tell her.
Right.
Same thing with anything. You know, if you look at a piece of land and you're like, this is just going to be here forever, it's fine, then you'll rape and destroy that thing. You won't care for it, or at least if it's not that aggressive, you'll at least not assume that one day it's going to be gone. And so we feel like that's just like a very big pathology in ourselves as humans, just not being able to like acknowledge that death is a factor.
Well, and that's a big, I think that's brilliant. And I think that that's another problem with veganism, is there's this idea that somehow you can eat without death. And there's a book I'm going to write a couple books down the road that is, my mom died 2 years ago this November, and I was the sole caretaker. I was her sole caretaker for many, many years. And one of the things I realized is, yeah, my grandma died, you know, back in 1990 or so, but if I were in a healthy, functioning community of, let's say, 120 people, by the time I got to be 60, I'm 59, by the time I got to be 60, I would have experienced, if you have 120 people and they average 60 years, that's two people dying a year, just to make the math easy. So I would have experienced 120 deaths by the time I get to 120 deaths of people fairly close to me. And honestly, there was, like, a friend died, but we were friends, and then we weren't friends for many years. So it's like, and then I read the newspaper, so it's like, not a big deal. It's completely absent. And that was another reason I started raising the chickens, is if I'm going to eat meat, I needed to be able to kill the ones I ate. And I think we're terribly absent from death, and we're terribly absent from our own deaths. We somehow think that we're going to live forever. I mean, if we were in full awareness of our mortality, would we spend time on Facebook? You know, I enjoy playing. I mean, it's true enough, and it's a joke, but it's also true. I enjoy playing, you know, the occasional computer game. I enjoy playing Left 4 Dead. That's a real game that I kind of like. But every time I do it, I think, well, there's 45 minutes that are gone in the hourglass forever. And it's a big question too, because I think about this a lot. And I mean, you can either put this in or not. I think this is less important. I mean, this is less, it's not ecological, but I think about this a lot. It's like, okay, so they found King Richard's bones in a parking lot a couple, 3 years ago. I don't know if you know about that.
I remember that.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, so King Richard's dead. He'd been dead for a long time. At this point, it doesn't really matter that he was king. And it's like, so what's the... I mean, the only thing I can come up with, I mean, what is, how should you spend your life? And, I mean, if you know that you're going to be dead and you're all going to be dust someday, it's like, does it really matter if I read a really good book or if I played a computer game? Does it really, so there's sort of the nihilistic perspective. It doesn't matter at all what you do. There's the hedonistic perspective. It's like, well, I mean, it just means to have lots of sex. You know, it's like, sex is a good reason to be alive and may as well have lots of it before you kick off. And then, I mean, the only thing I've really been able to come up with that's satisfying for me much is the legacy of leaving the world a better place than the world, by which I don't mean inventing something, though I don't mean the culture. Oh, that's something we should put in. I've been in enough movies to know that you're probably going to take about 5 seconds of what I did. So, I mean, I'm just going to throw this out in case also you can use a soundbite. Wait, now I've forgotten what it was. World a better place. Oh, yeah. Back about we don't know which world is real. Is that I hate the fact that when I say that it's crucial or critical or it's moral to leave the world a better place than it was when you were born, so often people confuse that with society, because when you say, I want for the world to be a better place, what that normally means is the economy. And, you know, it's like I would give talks at colleges and the students would ask each other, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And what that means is, what are you going to do when you have to get a job? But that's not the real world. The real world's right here. I mean, what am I going to do when I get out in the real world? I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? That's the real world. And so that's part of our confusion, too, and part of our insanity is we literally are confused about what is the real world. So if I say, I want to leave the world a better place, it's like, oh, great, you want to build a better mousetrap. You want to make a lot of money. You want to, it's like, no. I want for there to be more migratory songbirds every year than the year before, and more salmon, more lamprey, more. I want for there to be more soil every year than the year before. I want for there to be the average age of trees is older every year than the year before. And so that's another part, because we don't even recognize with our own lives that they're real. You know, if we recognize that our own lives are real, would we, as Pink Floyd said, tick away the moments of a dull day, frittering and wasting your life in an offhand way? Don't know. I don't think so.
It's my favorite Pink Floyd song.
Yeah.
It helped to radicalize me.
Yeah, it was a good one.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the great questions.
I mean, I had a list of questions, but I long put that down because you were covering everything that I wanted to talk about. And,
well,
you
know. Thanks for saying that. And I know what it's like to be, I mean, I've interviewed a bazillion people, and I know what it's like to interview people when they give you like 3-word answers. It's just a lot of work. It's like, oh, fuck. Like, the worst interview I ever did was, and he does great work. I'm not complaining about his work. Paul Watson. Of Sea Shepherds?
Yeah.
I interviewed him years ago. My first question was something like, so how are the oceans doing? He said, bad.
Yeah.
Care to...
extrapolate on that one, buddy?
And, I mean, that's, you know, I do these radio interviews, 45 to 48 minutes, and sometimes, I mean, the ones I love are the ones where I ask one question, they go for 25 minutes. It's like, But there have been some of them where we're 10 minutes into the interview. I've gone through all my questions because they're answering me with 3 sentences.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, shit, what am I going to do now?
Yeah. Well,
I'm sure that's happened to you, too.
Oh yeah, a bit. We've been very fortunate so far to have meet really cool people, because we're interviewing a lot of people who are like in the regenerative movement, so they kind of get a lot of these concepts. But I feel like you really tapped into like kind of where we were leading to a lot of this stuff. So thank you, because that helped a lot. A big part of this project is the there's the technicalities of soil and all these numbers and stuff, which we're going to cover. But it's also like, what's the bigger idea behind all this?
Right.
That's what we want to talk about. Should I ask the last question now?
Yeah, we're asking one question like across the board, because it's an interesting question. I think I already know Lier's answer, I think, but I don't know yours.
Okay.
So what do you want to have happen to your body after you die?
Oh, what do I want to have happen to my body after I die? I want to be eaten by bears. I hope. Ed Abbey, they stole his body and took it out in the desert. And I really want for either me to go off and disappear the last day or so, or I want for somebody to take my body and put it out so the bears can eat it.
Why the bears?
Because I love bears. And, you know, I'm a little bit torn, because I like vultures too. And it wouldn't be bad. It wouldn't be bad to be eaten by vultures. But I really like bears. Interestingly enough, I don't think they'll eat my bones, my big bones, because I've thrown rib bones out in the forest, and they don't eat them. So I've been asking people about this for a couple, 3 years now, asking like grizzly bear people, like, who eats a buffalo femur? And it ends up grizzly bears don't, because it's too big for them to crack. And so those are mainly worn down by wind and eaten by insects. And I know somebody who works a lot with bears up on the Alaskan coast, and the whales who wash up on shore, the bears can't break their big bones either. So those, same deal, they weather away. I love this topic. I love decay. It's just one of the most fascinating, cool things in the world. So bears, I'll tell you this, this tells you something about both myself and my mom. When I was in eighth grade, we had to do an experiment where you had a control and then a non-control. And that's all that mattered. Like, one person put one bean up against his TV and then one bean regular. And then after a couple months, he planted them to see if there was any difference. And mine was, do you remember the story?
I do.
I bought a fish.
You're still doing it.
Yeah, I am, really. I bought a fish, and a big fish, and I cut it in two. And I put half of it just on a wax paper on the surface. And I put the other half into water. And then I watched the difference in how they decayed. And the thing that's funny about this is that I was in eighth grade and therefore not very smart. And I did it in an outbuilding attached to our house. And about 3 days in, my mom goes, "What's that smell?" It's like, "Oh, it's my science experiment." "What's your science experiment?" I told her, and she made me clean it up. But it was just the most fascinating thing to watch this, to watch the difference. The one in water, for what it's worth, turned into basically chocolate milk that stunk. And the other one was, sorry to get too disgusting, but a pulsing mass of maggots.
It is fascinating decay.
Life, I think it finds a way.
I think it creeps most people out to know that no matter what you do, I mean, unless you cremate yourself, it's like something's gonna munch on you. I think.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. It's a weird thing, but it's like, it's gonna happen, man. Like, and it's beautiful. It's going back to everything else.
Alrighty, thanks everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as we did.
Please leave us a review and rate and subscribe on whatever app you use to listen to podcasts.
Anything helps, you know, any comment, like, and subscribe. It helps us get noticed more on these things, especially since we're a new podcast.
Yeah. And thank you to Danny Osterstock for the music. Have a good day, everyone.